Welcome to another exciting edition of National Bugle Radio on the Republic Broadcasting Network, republicbroadcasting.org, the last bastion of free speech. And also, go to nationalbugle.com. Do download the Co-Certified app. Test it out. So check out what it is to be non-kosher certified and have a non-kosher certified lifestyle. So today I have with me Professor Kevin MacDonald, who's just published a very interesting book about the origins of the European people. And I know this is something that he's been working on a long time. So, Professor MacDonald, first of all, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here, Patrick.
I'm very glad to have you here. So, I've heard you talk about this subject matter for a few years now, because you had an interest in it, and then you went off and did research and wrote the book. So this, it's not just on the origins of the European people, but it's on how those, the origins are origins, and we have a few different contributors to our gene pool, a few different ancestral contributors, and how they affect us today. You're a professor of psychology, and that's what you're interested in.
Right, that's what's, I suppose, different. I basically propose, based on recent population genetics research, right? I couldn't have written this book even 10 years ago because there's just so much research coming out. But there's a consensus now, three different groups coming into Europe prehistorically, hunter-gatherers who were there, primordially 40,000 years ago. They retreated with the Ice Age, came back. The Indo-Europeans, from the Pontic steppes, extremely militarized group, conquering group, and I'm sure we'll talk more about them. And then the early farmers who they came here about 8,500 years ago, and they are interesting, but they don't really contribute, I don't think, to contemporary European culture or historically.
You don't think so? But and yet they. The hunter-gatherers out of those three groups seem to have contributed the least amount of DNA, especially to people in Central or Southern Europe. Isn't that correct?
I'm sorry, I had the microphone. Yes, as you go north in Europe, there's a genetic climb, as we say, between the south of Europe, which is much more represented by the farmer genes. And then as you go north, you have more evidence for the Indo-Europeans and the hunter-gatherer genes. And Scandinavia having the highest number of hunter-gatherer genes. So, and it's interesting because what I found looking at the family historians, that in the south of Europe, their family patterns are much more collectivist. You have families living together, brothers living in the same house, and so on. That does not happen in North Europe, and certainly not in Scandinavia. So it's a very different ballgame. Mm-hmm. And as you go north in Europe, you get more individualism, more of a sense of detachment from close kinship relationships. The society relationships are not so much based on kinship as they are based on your reputation. So the Indo-Europeans and hunter-gatherers are both individualistic in different ways. And so they sort of blended together and created this unique European culture. But I still see evidence as you go north. I mean, I think the most individualist society are in Scandinavia, Sweden, for example. They're the least ethnocentric, and now they are being inundated by all this migration and everything, and I tie that all together within in the scope of the book to talk about immigration, how that has been something that especially Northern Europeans are very susceptible to. They, as I said, their groups are based not on kinship but more on a moral reputation. Are you a good person? Can I trust you? And what's happened, the sort of long story, very short, is that within the last 50 years, but accelerating, in the 20th century, you have these I talk about culture critique towards the end of the book. They've created these moral communities, that these moral in-groups of the left, basically. And part of that now is to support immigration and multiculturalism and, you know, the end of white identity and all that. That's a moral. Those are moral mm-hmm. imperatives. Mm-hmm. I trace that tendency back a long ways, especially, you know, after the English Civil War in the 17th century. There was a strong moral utopianism mm-hmm. that we see.
So I have, before we go on too far, I want to, just for the listeners, I want to nail down these three groups. So we've got the hunter-gatherers who had been in Europe for probably tens of thousands of years, and they were there before the glacial maximum, I guess is what you'd call it. So certainly before 20,000 years ago.
Yeah.
And they don't exist anymore in anywhere near a pure form. I guess maybe Estonians or Finns or Swedes may be 25% or 30% from that group, but they don't exist in anywhere near a pure form anymore. The next group to come in, the Middle Eastern farmers, they in Europe, they, because I've studied this for the sake of just ancient prehistory, and, you know, I'm very interested in what you're doing, because you're making the connection between this prehistory and you know, culture today, which is very interesting. But the second group that came into Europe, the Middle Eastern farmers, they still exist in almost a pure form in Sardinia, right?
Right, yeah, but 95% or so.
About, of all places in Sardinia. But you know, Southern Europe, they contribute the most to the gene pool of Southern Europe. And then also, they would be related to Middle Eastern people, presumably,
yes.
Right? And therefore, sometimes, you know, you got an Italian and you got a Jew, and it's kind of hard to tell the Italian and the Jew apart sometimes.
Mm.
Right? I mean, and that might be an explanation for it. And then this last group to come in, which is the most recent, the Indo-Europeans, also called the Yamnaya, but the Indo-Europeans, so they had been somewhere around, you know, the steppes, the north of the Black Sea, maybe north of the Caspian Sea, and some of them moved west into Europe, and others moved south into Iran and India, and that explains the related language. And virtually all of the languages spoken in Europe, with the exception of maybe Finnish, Hungarian, Basque, Estonian, they're all Indo-European languages, which would tend to indicate that these were a dominant group, that they came in and they dominated other groups. Is that a fair conclusion to reach?
Yes, it is a fair conclusion. They were a very militarized society, almost entirely militarized.
And they had the wheel, right?
They had what?
They brought the wheel. Is that correct?
Yeah, they invented the wheel. They domesticated the horse. They were very they made various technological improvements that I talk about in the second chapter. But the main thing is that they were entirely militarized. The whole culture was based on military success.
And how do we know they were militarized?
Well, you know, you go back, and I think the key book there is David Anthony's, mm-hmm. the horse and the wheel,
mm-hmm.
He talks about that, mm-hmm. how militarized they were, and that's why they expanded so far.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they would create these male bands. They were predatory. They would go out and they would conquer and basically, you know, dominate these people that they came in contact with. But they, you know, it was not based on kinship. It was based on your personal attributes. On, you know, are you a good soldier? Are you a good military leader? And so there was intense competition to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And these people, not based on military accomplishment, but based on your reputation. So then that way they're similar to the hunter-gatherers, that it's not kinship. They had these military groups, for example, in Germany, the Mannerbund, it was based entirely on your reputation, and it was above all the kinship groups. They would adjudicate disputes between kinship groups. The kinship was not the basis of the society. It was never like in the Arab world, mm-hmm. where your whole identity depends on your where you are in the kinship hierarchy. And the same with China and really most of the world. And that's the thing about that was so difficult about the West is that we are unique. This individualism is not found elsewhere. And, you know, it's just a different world out there where, you know, these people, like, I'm just reading this book about Arabs, you know, in the Middle Ages, and it was just entirely based on kinship. There was never a European society that was that mm-hmm. intensively mm-hmm. ethnocentric and based on clans and kinship. But, again, as you go north, even less so, and very individualistic. The only family ties they have are within the, you know, mother, mom, dad, the kids, and your immediate relatives. That's all. Mm-hmm. You don't branch out much. I mean, sure, you have other relatives, and it's just not as important as in these other societies.
Mm-hmm. So, in the case of the Indo-Europeans who moved south into India, there's been a lot of genetic studies of various Indian populations, and one thing that they have found is that whether you're in northern India, whether you're in southern India, you have disproportional overrepresentation of the Indo-European Y chromosome, which is carried from father to son, in all populations, and disproportional mitochondrial DNA which comes from women, it comes from the mother, in all populations, indicating that the Indo-Europeans would have conquered the previous population there, and men had preferential access to women. Right. And I assume it would be the same in Europe, but I'm not aware of studies. Have there been studies that show the same in Europe?
Well, I talked about that in the first chapter. I believe that is the case, and there's a study that came out that was supportive of that. I mean, if you think about it, these male bands are going out. They're not bringing a whole lot of women with them.
Mm-hmm.
And so when they go to these places, they're going to, you know, seize or whatever those women that are there. And so that means Y chromosome from the Indo-Europeans and the mitochondrial DNA coming from these other peoples. And that is what I believe happened. But it was challenged by this guy, David Reich, who's
I've read his book, but yeah, talk about David Reich.
He challenged that, but I was convinced by her reply, this other group's reply, that they were right about it, that the Y chromosome data is, you know, does show disproportionate Y chromosome contribution from the, you know, the males from the Indo-European males.
Well, you see, the thing is, I read his book. And I don't remember him talking about that, but I remember him talking about the disproportional contribution in India and other places. And I'm just wondering, because, you know, he is a nephew of an Orthodox rabbi and all of this, if it wasn't maybe a purposeful omission in this case. Because he's also under a lot of pressure, because the data that he is compiling and releasing is very, you know, it backs up a lot of our narratives, or even if it doesn't back up our narratives, it creates new narratives that are still, you know, useful to us.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, to me, what was clinching was that, and it just had a common sense level, was that this is how the Indo-Europeans always went about their adventures. They, there were male groups, and they would go out and see what they could conquer. That's basically what they did, and so I'm not at all surprised that it would happen in Europe. Why wouldn't it happen in Europe? Well, again, this is a controversy between these two groups, but I went along with the group that said that Y chromosome was disproportionate mm-hmm. in the European system, because that is the way they always went about
it. Right, and if it wasn't, it would be an anomaly.
It would be an anomaly if it didn't, yes.
Yeah. I have another question, and I haven't read your book, and I'm looking very much forward to doing so. But here's a question, and maybe it's something you've covered, maybe it's something you haven't considered. But the Greek myths, the Greek Greco-Roman myths, the Nordic myths, have a fair amount of overlap with, I guess, Hinduism in terms of, you know, sky gods and war gods. and, you know, chariots, things like, chariots pulled by horses. Have you given much thought to that in terms of being a reflection of the ancient culture?
Well, it doesn't really figure much at all, really, in my book. But I believe that people have talked about that. David Anthony probably talks about it. I wouldn't be surprised. Yeah, I mean, they're very similar because, this was a conquering culture, and they brought their gods with them and everything. And it was different when they went to India. And one of the themes in my book is that in Europe, at least, they did not set up barriers between themselves and the people that they conquered. There may have been barriers at first, but even then, I think the women were taken in some way. As time went on, though, the conquered people could move up in society. Mm-hmm. They did not have permanent walls like a caste system in India. And so this was very typical of Western Indo-European culture. I talk a lot about the Romans, because the Romans would go out and conquer other groups. And in most cases, they would end up becoming citizens in the long run.
And what seems to be the case in India is you had...
If they were at talent, they could move up, and they would use them as soldiers. Without that, Rome could not have expanded. They were a small group, so they kept recruiting these other people. If you had a prominent position in one of these conquered groups, you could oftentimes do a sort of parallel thing, and then you could become a consul or a very high ranking, in Rome. It wouldn't be right away, it'd be a couple of generations, but you could do it. The Romans were very open. And I think in terms of their, in a way, they were too open, because in the end, they really lost their people. They were swamped by all these other people. You had slavery and everything. And the Romans, I think the original Romans basically died out.
So I was going to point out that in India, you had apparently several centuries of mixing, but with preferential access to women from the Indo-Europeans, and then things got frozen into a caste system, and so for the past 2,000 years or so, there is no Indian ethnic group. You actually have just a myriad of not just language groups, but within the language groups of caste, and genetic research shows that there has been very little mixing between various castes and subcastes, which is very interesting. But in the case of the Romans, by the time the Romans were established, this was, a good millennia and several centuries after this Indo-European invasion of Europe. And so many of the groups that they were encountering, maybe not the Etruscans, because they didn't seem to speak an Indo-European language, but the Greeks, the Germans or Germanic peoples, the Celtic people, these are also people who are in large part descended from Indo-Europeans, correct?
You're right. Yeah. And so I think within Europe, the Indo-Europeans sort of found peoples that were more simpatical with them, and they did not put up those barriers, and that was true with the Germanic peoples too in Europe. They didn't set up big barriers. I have a section on the Goths, they didn't wall themselves off. So we are more open than other peoples to this kind of thing, but of course it can be maladaptive in the extreme.
Okay. Now, I've heard you talk for, a number of years ago, talking about the two different cultures of America, the Northern Puritan culture and then a Southern culture that was, more of a warrior culture. I'm not sure the wording you use for it. So what would be the origins of these two different cultures?
Well, that's a big topic of my book.
Folks, we're living in a world the likes of which we've never perceived any clearer than we do now. The plan for global governance has been in the works for generations and would have likely been achieved by now, but for the fact that the globalists left open their Achilles heel. With all their tools, Federal Reserve System, fiat currency, No Child Left Behind, and then Common Core education introduced to our schools to dumb us down, vaccines, pharmaceuticals to lobotomize us, GMO foods, insertion of compromised or bought and paid for politicians, judges, mainstream media propaganda, all pieced together like a puzzle designed to ultimately bring the world under submission. But with all their strategy, they forgot one thing: knowledge. And knowledge is power. With knowledge, their bombardment is nullified. Folks, with that, as brilliant and knowledgeable as you've become, among the wisest audience of any radio audience in the world, and you are, I want you to take a moment to reflect and ask yourself, how much of that knowledge did I obtain from Republic Broadcasting Network? How high has my consciousness been raised since I've been a listener? How fast am I now able to discriminate truth from fake news by being a Republic Broadcasting listener? How clear am I now able to see the world since I've been listening to RBN? Ask yourselves those questions, folks. Then ask yourself, what is that knowledge worth to me? Like my morning coffee, how would I survive without it? A voice of truth in a sea of lies. Do we not all need to make sure it survives? Like public broadcasting, we are now finding we can only survive with listener support. Censorship, advertisers being attacked, truth itself being attacked. It's the only way through this. We at Republic Broadcasting humbly ask you to become a supporter. Look at your budget and make a determination of what Republic Broadcasting is worth to you and what you can afford on a monthly basis. Go to republicbroadcasting.org and pledge 20, 30, 40, 50, if possible, 100 a month or more if it's affordable. Click the donate button and become a regular monthly donor. Assure both us and yourself that Republic Broadcasting truth will continue to flow like that morning coffee. The network thanks you.
It happens more often than we can imagine. In my case, I was sitting at home, and out of nowhere, I just started feeling uncomfortable. Then it got worse, and I started perspiring. I tried to ignore it, but I waited too long. The chest pain came as we were driving to the hospital emergency. I felt my life clock begin to tick. I barely survived. There was lots of damage done to my heart. What do I do now? I was lucky. I took a leap of faith and tried a 7-herb formula with hawthorn, garlic, cayenne, and more called Extendivite. Herbs have been used for thousands of years to keep us healthy. If you're not using Extendivite as a preventative supplement, maybe it's time to start. To order, call 1-877-928-8822 or visit heartdrop.com.
Extend your life with Extendivite.
So what would be the origins of these two different cultures?
Well, that was that's a big topic of my book. Essentially, the first four chapters are about the Indo-Europeans, the population genetics, the hunter-gatherers, and I talk about the family history, and then I talk about the Catholic Church. But in the sixth chapter, I talk about the Puritans, and I regard that as a fundamental break in Western history, that when they came, the rise of the Puritans really was the death knell of the aristocracy, and that has created a whole different ethic, much more egalitarian, much more prone to this moral universalism. This is where we are now. This has really shaped our culture. The Puritans were incredibly smart and successful. I mean, in America, they basically dominated America from the founding and before that, about 1960, when you had the rise of this new Jewish elite.
So these were the Eastern WASPs. You're describing them as being egalitarian as opposed to aristocratic.
Yeah, but they did not have a really aristocratic ethic, no. I talk a lot about these intellectuals, the Puritan descendant intellectuals of the 19th century, very prone to this moral idealism, very prone to egalitarian, very prone to, they hated slavery. These are the people who dominated the movement to end slavery. And promoted the Civil War. because of it. And, you know, they were prone to setting up these utopian communities, you know, like Brook Farm and all of that. They're very prone to helping immigrants and other people. A lot of social justice warriors coming out of this group in the 19th century. There are different, you know, different strands of it, but this was, I think, really, sheds light, I think, on white people's psychology, you know, coming out of that, you know, that ethos. And again, they dominated from the Ivy League universities. This was the sort of information culture of the 19th century. And they created a very mercantile culture, capitalist culture. It wasn't, you know, totally egalitarian by any means, but it really disdained the sort of aristocratic, inherited culture kind of thing that was much more characteristic of the South. And so it was a clash of cultures there. The Civil War, of course, was won by the North, and the Puritans set a very powerful economy, manufacturing economy, much more productive.
So
it's a foregone conclusion. He's going to win that.
This more egalitarian Puritan culture. Now, do you see that as having a link to the hunter-gatherer culture, which hunter-gatherers typically are more egalitarian?
Yes, that is one of my theses. That's not, you know, entirely nailed down, but you see the same climb, really, that you see genetically with hunter-gatherer genes being more prominent in Scandinavia and egalitarianism being much more common in Scandinavia. Scandinavian societies historically have been the most egalitarian around. You know, they just don't have big social class differences. If you look at executive pay, even in the modern age, and it's not, they don't have these huge gaps, even you see it in this country.
So, and these Puritans, they came from England. Now, the Southern aristocracy, who maybe you see as representing more of the Indo-European tradition, they also came from England, though, right?
Yeah, but they're very different types of people in England. That's why they're really...
So they're very different...
David Hackett Fisher's book, and relying on that to some extent. You know, the origin of the Puritans was Scandinavian. They emigrated to England about the 6th century.
So are they, the Puritans come from the region of England that was called the Danelaw that had been colonized basically by Vikings?
Especially East Anglia.
Mm-hmm.
But with the eastern part of England, they come over there before the Danes, about the 6th century. But yeah, there's a substantial amount of Scandinavian blood in England, whereas the Anglo-Saxons in the south were much more Germanic and more hierarchical, more prone to the sort of Indo-European kind of model of society, the aristocratic model. And that was eventually overturned. The English Civil War, as I say, I think is a turning point in the history of the West.
So there's a podcast, it's called the History of English Podcast, and I recommend it. It's very interesting. Yeah, it's done by a linguist, and he's maybe an etymologist. He traces the etymology of words in the English language. It's very interesting, and he starts from the beginning. He starts from Indo-European contributions to the English language. But one of the takeaways that I've gotten from that is that England is far from homogenized.
No, it's not.
That. Very, and there's been studies, even, you know, going back before we had even the better genetics, but now we've got these great genetic techniques, and you have one shire of England that has very different genealogical background, you know, that much more Scandinavian here, much more Germanic down there, or maybe even Celtic in some places.
Heavenly flower.
You are tuned in to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Visit our website by going to republicbroadcasting.org.
Hey, gang. Patrick Slattery here with an important message that is pertinent to anyone who shops for groceries, eats food, or just has an inquisitive mind like myself. What I'm about to introduce you to is a segment of our food culture that has been kept so low profile to the American public that virtually no one is aware of how dominant it is on our refrigerator and cupboard shelves. What I'm talking about is the kosher certification industry and the new app, Koshertified, that delivers a comprehensive education on all aspects regarding this little-known practice. After reviewing this app, I found that it is useful for practically anyone who purchases food, regardless of their religious faith or identity. Its database of products not kosher certified is a win-win convenience for all food-conscious people. So why not check out thekosherquestion.com or click on the link at nationalbugle.com and see how modifying your grocery shopping with the Koshertified app can make a huge difference for your future.
Tired of being lied to by mass media? It's growing more and more apparent today that news is received less and less through standard media outlets. Even with a growing audience every day, RBN is beginning to direct more efforts into social media. Social media and the use of the internet is fast becoming the primary source of people for news, regardless of demographic. RBN has set out to provide some of the best news on the internet through republicbroadcasting.org and also has begun to use the tools to our advantage by way of social media. Republic Broadcasting is now operating a Facebook page to function as yet another avenue to have our collective voice reach new audiences across not only America, but across the globe as well. The Facebook page features not only news, but also an RBN player to listen to our broadcast. Get involved by visiting facebook.com/republicbroadcasting and liking our page and share it with your friends and family, because you can handle the truth.
Many people write us about their experience with Extendivite. Allow me to read you some from Amazon.com. It really does work like the review says it does. I cannot believe that after the first few days, I didn't feel as sluggish or clogged up. It has had a profound impact on my physical, emotional well-being. I'm skeptical as most people about products and their claims, and I never write reviews, but this is a wonderful product and I recommend it to everyone. Great product. It has brought my blood pressure from the mid-150s over the 80s to the mid-130s over mid-80s. Along with diet and exercise in just the past couple of months. Excellent. Thank you, David. Tell us your story. Get Extendivite today. Call 1-877-928-8822 or visit heartdrop.com.
Extend your life with Extendivite.
And you know, you have one shire of England that has very different genealogical background. You know, much more Scandinavian here, much more Germanic down there, or maybe even Celtic in some places. And it's also reflected in the language, in different words that are still used in Yorkshire. They are of Viking origins or Old Norse origin, and they're not down in other places.
Yeah, I spent some time on the Quakers, and they were from the Danelaw area. They were originally from Denmark and Scandinavia, and they were extremely talented. And they were very important for the anti-slavery movement in England. And so I have a chapter on the anti-slavery movement and other sort of egalitarian movements of the 19th century in England. And I think but ultimately it really stems from the Puritan victory. But then it became even more extreme with the Quakers, and it had dramatic effects. I mean, ending slavery. No other culture has ever ended slavery for moral reasons. And that's what happened in the West. Very important for people to understand that in an age when we're all accused of being congenital racists.
Mm-hmm. And what's counterintuitive is that the parts of England that had the most Scandinavian contribution and presumably the most Viking contribution, these are people descended from Vikings who came in, or Scandinavians who typically came a little bit later than the Anglo-Saxons. And so, they're the conquerors, and yet now they are the people kind of committing a mass surrender without a fight.
Yeah, yeah.
How do you explain that, especially as a psychologist?
Yeah, I think that there are different strands even within Scandinavia that you had this Viking group, and they were a typical, really an Indo-European kind of model of these raiding, marauding male groups. You know, but within England though, they came over from Denmark in much larger numbers, and they settled. So they were, I think they reflected more of the wider population as well of Denmark. But, that is something that could be investigated. But in my book, I argue that essentially the Vikings were not typical of most of Scandinavian society. Mm-hmm. That it was much more egalitarian. And the thing about the Scandinavian, they did not undergo feudalism. You had a peasant, farmer class that was represented in the parliament in the Middle Ages. They did not have the kind of really exploitative feudal system, which is really a carryover of the Indo-European model, where you have this aristocratic elite dominating, the lower orders. But Scandinavia really didn't happen that way. It was much more egalitarian from a long time ago. Prehistorically, the peasants actually were often opposed to the nobles, and they were on the side of the king because they saw the king as more on their side. And again, they had more political representation. They were freer, really, than any peasants in Europe during the Middle Ages. Mm-hmm. And versus on slavery, what was going on in the continent and in much of England.
So, I don't know a whole lot about Iceland, but Iceland, of course, was founded by Vikings, and Iceland is also the home of the oldest parliament, the oldest still existing parliament, the Althing. Yeah. So, is that a reflection of a Scandinavian egalitarianism?
Yeah, it is. I think the Althing is a representative institution and adjudicates disputes between kinship groups or whatever. But Scandinavian society just has a very, very long history of sort of representation, much more than any other part of the West.
So, in your book, you trace prehistory and then through this history that we're talking about in England, the Puritans, and then a more aristocratic class that settled this South and dominated the southern states, the Confederacy. And now we've got this situation today. Is there a way out for us?
I have a chapter on psychology, psychological mechanisms of moral communities. The whole previous part of the book is about sort of establishing the importance of moral communities for the West. And again, as opposed to kinship, you have these groups that are based on your moral reputation. Hunter-gatherer groups would be that way. Essentially that's what we're up against now, is that the moral high ground has been seized by the left, essentially the Jewish left. Mm-hmm. That's what the book, The Culture Critique. So this new book intersects with The Culture Critique, because the argument is basically that you have the meeting of this more egalitarian culture prone to these moral communities and moral utopianism, meeting this Jewish group who was a rising, intellectual elite. And the way I see it is that the Jewish intellectuals understood this about the West. And so even in the Culture Critique, I was aware of this, that they were portraying the West as morally deficient and portraying their own groups and their own intellectual movements as epitome of good. And so what you have essentially is the creation of a moral community of the left now. And that's been accelerating, of course, in recent years, but it certainly became dominant, I think, in the 1960s. So in my view, you have three big stages of European history after the new Europeans came, dominated by the European kind of culture. But then, in the 17th century, the rise of the Puritans. But then since especially after World War II, and certainly in the 1960s, they had the rise of the Stalin Jewish elite. And that Jewish elite fundamentally hates the people that they are dominating, and but they are using this moral in-group thing to make us feel guilty about our past, and to make all this, you know, social justice warrior things being moral imperatives. And I when you look at people on the left, that's the way they think. I mean, they really think in terms of, you know, what's good and what's evil, and racist, Nazi, it's evil, and so on. So I go through that long chapter, a lot of different psychological mechanisms, but I suppose that's the most important one.
Okay.
So how do you overcome that? I don't know. I mean, in the last chapter, I do mention revolution. I mean, a civil war being a possibility. A lot of people are talking about that now.
Well, it seems to me that we're in this situation because we're too polite. We're too polite to hurt the Jewish feelings. I mean, frankly, that there's this politeness, and because there's no pushback, because we're not willing to talk about what's going on, there's no pushback. The more extreme elements of the Jewish power structure, they push harder and harder, and then the less extreme elements become more and more worried because, geez, I mean, if people started talking about, you know, all of the wars that we're getting pushed into, if people started talking about the replacement level immigration and started linking it to Jews, then we're going to be in trouble. And so the less extreme elements are worried. And you see this, like, there are people like, you're probably familiar with, say, Glenn Greenwald, for instance, or I talk a lot about a Russian historian, Stephen F. Cohen. And they seem to be very, like, they obviously don't like the policies. They're very opposed to the policies, or at least a great deal of the policies, the foreign policies of this Jewish establishment. And yet, if they were to start naming the Jew themselves, you know, then what's going to happen?
Yeah, right. Well, I talk a lot about, you mentioned conformity, but, you know, people don't want to. I also talk about personality research, Richard Lynn's book, that white people are the nicest people in the world. And when that means we're the most empathic, we're the most giving, as it were. And that, you know, that's being taken advantage of. You know, whenever there's a drowning child that's trying to get into Europe, I mean, it's all over the newspapers. Why? Because it triggers white people. White people are more likely to be concerned about that kind of stuff. And I also talk about conformity. And so, the interesting thing about Scandinavia, as individualistic as it is, in terms of family structure, they are very conformist. And they don't talk about these things. I mean, immigration is completely off the radar. And if you do talk about it, you'll be quickly labeled a Nazi. And again, they hate the shunning. You know, that white people, because of the importance of moral reputation in white communities, they are horrified at being called a bad person. You're racist. Okay, that's the worst thing in the world. And they shrink from that. So it's very effective propaganda, and those are some of the psychological mechanisms that are killing us at the moment. But yeah, I also talk about, but I don't think the media is having the effect it used to have. You know, Donald Trump was elected after all in the teeth of this, and I think that you know, you're going to see more and more of that as time goes on, I hope. Mm-hmm. But the thing about an egalitarian society is that there's a lot of high trust in other people. You know, Scandinavian societies are notoriously high trust societies. And that's good in a lot of ways. But if you trust people, it's very easy to get a consensus. You know, in these groups, decisions are made by consensus. And people don't tend to dissent from consensus. So these cultures become very conformist. And people are afraid to rock the boat. They're afraid to be stand out, really, even though they're individualists in a lot of ways. When it comes to family structure, when it comes to conformity, they're extremely, extremely concerned about preserving their reputation.
Now, in Europe, we have this north-south Klein genetically, with Scandinavia in particular having the most of this hunter-gatherer ancestry, and then Southern Europe having the highest percentage of Middle Eastern farmer. And I guess the Indo-European is spread more evenly than these other two ancestral groups. But when you look at Europe, where are you having probably the most resistance to mass immigration right now? You had in Italy this year, you had an effective leader, Matteo Salvini, who was the interior minister, not the prime minister. He's out of office now, but looks like he'll come back. So there's some pushback in Italy, popular pushback. I guess there's popular pushback in Greece. Hungary, which, I'm not sure. I'd have to check back on the relative mixture of these three groups amongst Hungarians. But it's in the north where it seems the most hopeless. And you see this, you think that there is some sort of either genetic or cultural or, mixture of the two connection.
Yeah, I mean, my view is that it is part of genetic, yeah. It's a genetic. I have an argument in the family chapter that this is an ethnic phenomenon. You can't explain it in a way. But it's also, certainly the culture goes along with it, and different ethnic groups create different cultures.
Mm-hmm.
I
remember as a kid reading the science fiction novel Journey to the Center of the Earth, and I guess the protagonist, he's probably from France, and he goes off to Iceland, right? And they go into Iceland, and the Icelanders were described as well. They don't hug each other. They don't speak with their hands. They don't gesticulate. They're just more reserved than the more Latin French. The French are more Latin, although I guess the French are actually more Germanic and Celtic than anything else, but they speak a Romance language. And my father is saying kind of the same thing about Italians as opposed to English people, that, there's this difference. So it's something that just like a lot of things that people have recognized for a while, there are these different personality traits north and south in Europe.
Yeah, I think that is the case. More gregarious, more extroverted. In the South, I don't make a big deal out of that. Again, what Richard Lynn does, he doesn't distinguish in that way. And so I base my personalities, race differences, talk about personality in his book. Mm-hmm. He just talks about white people versus other groups, mm-hmm. find that they're more empathic, which means they're more prone to being nice, and being sympathetic to other people, that sort of thing. Africans being the opposite.
Mm-hmm. And you think of Africa, the early accounts of Africa. Have you ever heard of the book, The Negro in Negroland? I think it's what it was called. It's a compilation of very, very early accounts from both Western and Arab explorers or traders in Africa. And it paints a very grim picture of what Africa was like.
I think Phil Rush should use that kind of material. He wrote a paper on that. Mm-hmm. And I think Jared Taylor's talked about it.
So, the idea of revolution, people talk about revolution, and yet first of all, every time you see any act of violence, it winds up being effectively used against us.
It's hard to see how that's going to happen. It's all going to happen, but what I see is an awful lot of polarization now. That people can't talk anymore to each other, and it's like before the Civil War, people made that analogy. And people on the left want to really abrogate the Constitution. They want to take away the guns and all of this kind of thing. I mean, we haven't. They want to get rid of two senators. Yeah. They want to have the illegals vote, all kinds of things. Open borders completely, you give illegal aliens free medical care. All that. Mm-hmm. I think the left is getting so extreme. And they're already talking about, changing the Constitution packing the Supreme Court. Get rid of the Electoral College, two senators, all those things, because they know that the left benefits from that, because they you got a state like California with like almost 40 million people, and they've imported all these immigrants. They're going to vote massively to the left, but that doesn't change how many electoral votes they have. So that's the kind of thing that I think is going to put people over the line at some point. I think if Trump was reelected, I think there would be riots out from the left for sure in all the major cities, and there'd be big civil disorder because these people are just the fact that he's elected the first time is bad enough, but twice, they go nuts.
You know, just in the past few days, there was a conservative Christian news site. It's called True News, and they came out and said what's going on with the impeachment. This is a Jew coup. That's their term for it, a Jew coup. I've been calling this, not just the impeachment, but all of the Never Trumpism and the Jew d'état, and it's successful. It's successful. It's prevented him from.
Homeowners, if your lender has gone out of business or sold your transaction to another lender or servicer, you may be the victim of a wrongful foreclosure resulting in the loss of your home. If you've already lost your home, are in foreclosure, or even in good standing, you can challenge the mortgage transaction's illegal issue and your property can be restored to you, and your foreclosure can be stopped or reversed and the mortgage transaction declared unenforceable. State laws, U.S. title codes, the Uniform Commercial Codes, and U.S. Supreme Court rulings have upheld that defective mortgage documentations can reverse or stop foreclosures and enforce property title claims in favor of the homeowner. We are having successes in stopping the process of foreclosure, the enforcement of the foreclosure judgments, the sale of property, and evictions after the sale. We are not attorneys, and we don't give legal advice. We are a professional team of legal researchers, providing forensic mortgage audits and expert witnesses. We have the knowledge to produce the evidence and enforce laws regarding your legal issues. We've been in business for 12 years without a complaint. Consultations are free, and we provide a free title search to confirm if your mortgage has legal defects. Please call 855-253-3748. 855-2-KEEP-IT today.
Corporate media dominates the American opinion. Finding independent voices that counter this avalanche is becoming increasingly difficult. With the endless corruption running rampant throughout our government, independent voices are needed more than ever to battle the offensive against our freedoms and liberties. As a listener of RBN, no one understands this concept better than you. Now it's up to you to do your part. The time has come for you to take action and begin broadcasting the truth to hundreds or thousands of people every month. Sound impossible? Quite the contrary. With pointed slogans from LibertyStickers.com, you can reach countless sleeping Americans unaware that they live in a real-life wonderland. LibertyStickers.com has a huge inventory of political bumper stickers and messages that reflect the truth about our government, our politicians, and the future of America. With so many in stock, there's one perfect for you. Visit us today at LibertyStickers.com. Again, that's LibertyStickers.com. Do your part. Your voice is important. Let it be heard.
Talk Right, the conservative app offered by TalkStream Live that caters exclusively to the conservative talk radio community. Here you'll see only talk shows and podcasts from the conservative right, all the big broadcast names and online digital shows in one place. Talk Right makes it easy to find all your favorite conservative talkers with all the upscale features you come to expect from TalkStream Live. Keep up with the fast-paced political world. Download Talk Right today from Google Play or the App Store.
Hey, is that a new music app?
Yeah, check it out. Surfer Music Discovery. It links to thousands of online stations, but the twist is you see the song names and artists that are now playing live.
That's different. No guessing. Looks like a waterfall of music.
So many formats. Rock, oldies, country, R&B, jazz, and a whole lot more.
How's that spelled?
Surfer. S-U-R-F-R.
Is it expensive?
It's free. No need to sign up or sign in.
Get the Surfer Music app free from Google Play or the App Store.
You know, not just the impeachment, but all of the Never Trumpism, the Jew d'état, and successful. It's successful. It's prevented him from governing. He's kind of like a glorified U.S. trade representative who gets to live in the White House. He doesn't have much control over his own government, it seems. But I thought it was very significant that you had. Conservative Christians who they have a very, very large YouTube channel and don't even care that they're going to lose it because I guess they get most of their traffic directly to their website. So it's a pretty big platform, and here they are speaking explicitly about the Jewish power in the United States. and you've got other people who are kind of teetering on the edge, who talk, who don't say the word Jew, but they keep talking about basically your term, a hostile elite, like Tucker Carlson, and then maybe Rush Limbaugh. And it seems to me that we might be on the brink of people actually doing away with this taboo, because without the taboo, what maintains Jewish power? Because you've written a lot about the Jewish priority of combating anti-Semitism, you know, even more than supporting Israel. And right. What are they going to do if they can no longer hold back talk about Jewish power?
Yeah, I mean, they are desperate. I mean, you see the ADL, they had a list of people they wanted to get off Twitter. I was included in there, David Duke, Richard Spencer, They want to control all the information, and they want to get back to the days when there were, three networks, and they were all owned by Jews, and they were just sort of little variations from each other. So I think that's what they want to get back to. They may succeed to some extent. They may get thrown off Twitter. They got rid of Jared Taylor.
I was just going to say, it seems to me that they only feel safe in a society run by Jews. But the reason that is so is because when the society is run by Jews and they prevent anybody from talking, their behavior becomes so extreme that if people did start talking about it, then they would feel endangered. Maybe I'm not explaining it well, but it's kind of a vicious circle.
Yeah, I mean, it is. And I do think that is really their Achilles heel.
If they could just declare victory and enjoy their riches, but not insist on completely ruling politically. Have you ever thought of the difference between the Jews who dominate us economically and politically in our homelands and the Chinese, the overseas Chinese, that economically dominate Southeast Asia, but politically are much less involved?
I think that exact point, and mm-hmm. I wrote a preface to A People That Shall Dwell Alone called Diaspora Peoples, and that was the thing that struck out me doing the research on overseas Chinese. They never went in and bought up all the media. They didn't get messages about how the culture of the natives was pathological and all that, even though there were anti-Chinese riots at times.
Mm-hmm.
That never happened. The Jews really wanted, I just got a submission, Doctrinal Observer, about how Jews have bought up all the newspapers in Maine, all of them. The small little weeklies or two bi-weeklies to every, that's the way it is. So they want to control the information.
Well, Professor McDonald, I know you said you only had an hour and were about up, but I would love to have you come back and talk more about these issues.
Yeah, and maybe you could take a look at the book, and then we could have some really you may have some criticisms and be interesting.
I will definitely buy your book, and I'll be reading it over the holidays, and then I'll come back and ask you questions.
Okay, good.
Well, thank you very much.
Okay. Yeah.
Many people tell us about their experience with Extendivite. Just listen to what Glenn has to say.
Prior to taking it, I had diabetic neuropathy. The Extendivite reduced that significantly. Acid reflux was reduced. I had athlete's foot, very severe. Trimmed that down to about 75% dandruff. Almost completely gone. I had occipital neuralgia at the base of my skull. I was having migraines, reduced by about 90%. Heart palpitations, my heart would kind of stall out. I would skip a beat. Very uncomfortable. And when walking from downstairs going to sleep, by the time I got to the bedroom, which is just one flight of stairs, my heart was pounding, coming out of my chest. My vision was blurry. This completely solved that problem. Great product. Thanks.
Tell us your story. Get Extendivite today. Call 1-877-928-8822 or visit heartdrop.com.
Extend your life with Extendovite.
You're listening to Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.